Welcome to Torah Tzimacha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Chavi Swidler Eisenberg, and today we will be studying Sefer Amos, Chapter 2. Yesterday we introduced the prophet Amos and examined his personal background, the historical context for his prophecies, the structure of the Sefer, and the repeating motif in the opening chapters, which lists three unspecified sins of the surrounding nations that God would forgive, but the fourth sin is unforgivable, and then names this fourth sin. And therefore, God will be punishing each of these nations. Today, we will focus further on these unforgivable sins of the nations, and we will be looking not only in chapter 2, but we will return to chapter 1 to have another look at all the sins of all the nations that are described, to try to detect an overarching theme, and then we'll continue Amos's prophecy to the kingdom of Israel in the north. Amos's diatribes about the sins of the surrounding nations each have the same style and flow, so it's likely that after hearing the first few speeches, his audience is now quite familiar with the repeating rhetorical patterns. We can just imagine that for those Israelites who are listening in the public market, or perhaps envision Amos writing a series of editorials in the local newspapers, or a series of blog posts appearing in the latest talk shows, or whatever the ancient equivalents are of the latest reels on TikTok or Instagram, that as soon as he started his typical speeches, his audiences would know what motif, language, and structure to expect to hear with each of his successive messages. Just as when I introduced my recordings with "Welcome to Torah Tzimacha Nach Yomi," etc., you immediately know that I'm going to be addressing another chapter of Nach. It will last approximately 12 to 15 minutes, and that my style of rhetoric will fit into that general genre of speeches. So too, when Amos's audience hears him open up once again with "Al shlosha pish'ei v'al arba'a lo ashivenu," for three transgressions of X nation, I can forgive, but not a fourth, his audience is eagerly anticipating to learn who will be the subject of the latest critique. And each day the crowd would grow in popularity as Amos moves from one enemy nation to another, lambasting and warning of the impending punishments. We must ask, isn't there a core concept in Judaism of teshuva, the process of repentance? What sin or sins is Amos describing that could possibly be so unforgivable? What is the common thread between all the crimes of the other nations that could not be overlooked? The Metsudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler of Prague, who lived from 1687 to 1769, explains that the three sins that appear in Amos's speeches refer to the three cardinal sins of murder, adultery, and idolatry, and that the fourth sin is only to rubber stamp the already impending punishment. Alternatively, according to Rashi and Radak, God, in his compassion, is willing to forgive the first three sins, whatever they are. However, the fourth sin is one step too far for him to forgive. So what exactly is the nature of the fourth sin that causes such harsh punishments? Let's take a closer look at the sins of each nation as described by the prophet. Maybe we can understand their extreme nature. Amos starts in chapter 1, verse 3, focusing on Damascus, which is the nation of Aram. They're accused of threshing Gilad with threshing swords of iron, which means that they plowed over human beings. To plow fellow men like one plows a field using instruments with metal spikes is well beyond standard warfare. In verse 6, we focus on Aza, which is Gaza, the nation of the Plishtim or the Philistines. The Philistines pursued escaped refugees to sell them off into slavery. Refugees are extremely vulnerable people who are already homeless and on the run from their enemies. So the Plishtim running after them to capture and sell into slavery is adding further agony to their already intense suffering. In verse 9, we turn to Tzur, Tyre, who ignored their covenant of brotherhood. This refers to the seemingly ironclad treaty established between King Shlomo and King Hiram when Shlomo was building the first temple. Instead of honoring their agreement, they ignored it for their own financial gain and exiled an entire nation. In verse 11, we turn to Edom. They pursued a nation who was expected to be treated like a brother, which is referring to Am Yisrael, and purposely suppressed their own compassion. They acted with deliberate cruelty. Chapter 1, verse 13 looks at Ammon, and it accuses them of ripping open the wombs of pregnant women to pursue territorial expansion. And then in chapter 2, verse 1, we turn to Moab, who burned the bones of the king of Ammon into paste. Now, burning to dust the bones of royalty is far from standard warfare. What is the common thread among all these sins? Rav Yitzchak Eitz Shalom recently published a groundbreaking work on Sefer Amos, and whose material I will be referring to in much of my shiurim. So he points out that all of these sins listed are actually war crimes, and there are conventional moral norms that every nation is expected to adhere to without God issuing a specific commandment, and that these nations are presumed to maintain a basic level of human decency. So it's this extreme cruelty exhibited here by the nations that is unforgivable, and it stirs up God's explosive wrath. Consider, for those in the northern kingdom of Israel who are standing in the marketplace, quite possibly in the capital city of Shomron, listening to these speeches of Amos, these harsh messages are all good news, because they're all about the enemy nations, those who have caused so much trouble to Israel. Perhaps they would even be cheering in agreement and yell out, hurrah, or hey, Dad. It would be helpful at this point to have a map of ancient Israel in front of you, as it's easier to get a better understanding of the territory of ancient Israel and the surrounding nations. But I'll do my best to describe the locations. Rabbi Eitz Shalom describes the geographical features of Amos' prophecy. He starts with Damascus in the kingdom of Aram, which is to the northeast of Israel in modern-day Syria. Then he jumps right over Israel all the way to the enemy in the farthest southwest to Gaza. And then he leaps again to the northwest to Tsur, Tyre, which is today in southeastern Lebanon. And then he skips over Israel again to points southeast to Edom. And then he goes to Ammon, which is north of there, which is still east of the Jordan River, in what is today part of the northern part of Jordan. And then he goes on to Moab, which is just south of that, still on the eastern bank of the Jordan River. One can almost feel the visceral sigh of relief and cheers and agreement from the audience as the citizens of the Kingdom of Israel listen to Amos lambaste all their rivals. Rav Benny Lau, whose contemporary commentaries on various works of Navi turn obscure ancient prophecies into accessible messages that are meaningful even to our modern sensibilities, asks an important question. We know from the opening verse of the Sefer, which describes Amos as Asher Chaza al Yisrael, who prophesied on Israel. This stresses that the main audience for the bulk of Amos' prophetic messages is the northern kingdom of Israel. If this is so, why would Amos spend all this time in the first two chapters of the Sefer addressing the surrounding nations? Why are these messages to the foreign nations so important for Amos to deliver? Rav Benny explains that for his main audience in the kingdom of Israel, Amos is an outsider. As we learned in chapter 1, Amos is from Tekoa, a city in the southern kingdom of Judah. At this time, the Judean kingdom in the south is actually an enemy of Israel, and the last person they want to listen to is a prophet from the southern kingdom. Thus, Amos's national identity creates an added layer of tension between him and his prospective audience, and serves as an additional barrier for them to be receptive to his rebuke. So how does one gain trust from a potentially hostile audience? Amos demonstrates through these introductory prophecies that one builds such credibility by criticizing their enemies. Every day Amos comes to the public square with a new prophecy and criticizes another rival nation. And then in chapter 2, verse 4, it's even more dramatic when he turns on his own people, the nation of Yehudah. Now, the criticism is less harsh than that of the surrounding nations. It's not about a specific act of cruelty. Instead, it rebukes them for violating the Torah. But the people in the kingdom of Israel understand and accept that the Beit HaMikdash is in Jerusalem, in Judea. And therefore, that's the land where God's laws apply. So they accept that this type of critique of their rivals. And it's impressive for them to hear Amos speak so harshly against even his own countrymen. He's a defector, a turncoat, a traitor. Now he's got their attention. Now they'll trust him. The people of Shomron are standing around, listening to his oration against their enemies, and they're all ears. They figure, if Amos had a message for them, he'd have already told them earlier in his series of speeches, so they think they're safe from his attacks. Amos has spent all this time building up their trust, and then, just as he has their undivided attention, he starts up again in Pasuk 6, with the same pattern, Al Shlosha Pish'ei Yisrael. Yalar ba'alo ashivenu. On the three sins of Israel, I can forgive, but on the fourth, I will not. This is absolutely shocking to them. And unlike the previous seven nations, where Amos described one major sin, here he doesn't stop there. He lists not just three sins, but a total of seven sins. Among the sins listed include selling people into slavery for a pair of shoes, immorality where a father and son visit the same prostitute, possibly even a temple prostitute, and they justify their behavior by taking the clothes off the poor and selling them and using that money for supposedly holy purposes in foreign god temples. At this point, the prophet once again changes the pattern. After listing the sins, as he did in the previous cases, instead of immediately moving on to the punishment, in verses 9 through 11, God rebukes them by tracking their history. "And I destroyed the Amorites from before them, and I brought you up from the land of Egypt, and I led you in the desert for 40 years to inherit the land of the Amorites. I raised you up into prophets and your children into Nizirim." God took you out of slavery, and now you're selling others into slavery? God is telling them, "I turned you into a holy nation to sanctify me. Shame on you for not understanding the purpose of that salvation from slavery." The Dat Mikra points out that the use of the words Nizirim in verses 11 and 12 does not necessarily refer to actual Nizirim or Nazirites, those who refrain from consuming wine, but as a general term to refer to people who live lives of holiness and sincerity, possibly educators and other role models, according to Targum Yonatan. "Now you're corrupting the innocent people in your midst, not allowing people to maintain their wholesome nature. You too will face your punishment." Let's recap. Today we took a closer look at the specific sins of each of the listed nations, understanding the extremely cruel nature of their sins. The prophet then moved from criticizing each nation to zeroing in on the sins of the northern Israelite kingdom, and Amos utilized this approach of focusing on the surrounding nations as a tool to develop their trust. Once he established his credibility among his listeners, he shifted to his central message to the kingdom of Israel, that their sins, just as the other nations, are likewise unforgivable, and their punishment is coming. In the next chapter, we will learn more about this impending punishment. Thank you for studying together L'Iluy Nishmat, Gilbert Carcenti, Menachem Mendel, Ben Saud.